In a back office on the Sun Microsystems campus in Palo Alto, in 1991, a soft-spoken Canadian engineer named James Gosling is staring out the window at an oak tree. He has been staring at this tree off and on for months. He is, on paper, leading a small project called the Green Project, three engineers working on the software that would, in theory, run inside the next generation of cable television remotes. The cable companies want a smart remote, a thing with a small screen and a few buttons that can show a guide and order pay-per-view movies. Gosling is supposed to write the program that runs inside it. Every time he gets close, the cable company picks a different chip, and his code, which was written for the old chip, becomes a brick. Then he rewrites it for the new chip. Then they change again. The chips are different not by a little, but by a lot. The way a French oven is different from a Japanese rice cooker. The instructions one of them understands are not even close to the instructions the other one understands. He gets tired of this. He starts writing, in the margins of his notebook, a kind of wish. He wishes for a program that could be written once, on his desk, in any language he chooses, and that could then run on every chip the cable company decides to ship, without him ever having to touch the program again. He wishes the chip would do the translation, not him. He wishes for a fake chip, a chip that pretends to be every other chip, a chip made entirely of software. The cable television project does not work out. The cable companies lose interest. The remote never ships. The Green Project nearly gets canceled. But the fake chip, the chip that lives only inside another program, the chip that translates the wish into the real instructions of whatever real chip happens to be underneath, that fake chip survives. Sun renames it. The fake chip is called the Java Virtual Machine, and the language that runs on top of it is called Java. And on the 23rd of May, 1995, Sun ships it to the world. This is Rust, gently. A patient introduction to how computers actually work and to one particular language for talking to them. I am your host. This is episode 28, the JVM in plain words. Today, I want to give you a clear picture of one of the most consequential pieces of software ever built, the Java Virtual Machine, the JVM, and a clean understanding of what it does, what it costs, and why it is everywhere. By the end of this episode, you will understand what people mean when they say write once, run anywhere, what the JVM is doing under the hood, why it runs so much of the world, and what it asks for in return. This is the foundation under the next four episodes of this season, which are about a particular piece of data software that is built on the JVM, the cost of building it that way, and the alternative being built in Rust. Let me set the scene more carefully. When you write a program, you do it in a language a human can read. You write the word read, the word add, the word save. Your computer's processor, the small piece of silicon at the heart of your laptop, cannot read any of those words. It reads only numbers. Not even decimal numbers like the ones you write checks in, but binary numbers, ones and zeros, in patterns that mean things like load this value into that register, add these two numbers, jump to this address in memory. Every brand of processor speaks its own dialect of these instructions. A processor made by Intel speaks one dialect. A processor made by Apple speaks another. A processor inside a cheap parking meter speaks a third. The dialects are not compatible. A program written for one will not run on the other, in the same way that a recipe written in French cannot be cooked by a kitchen that only reads Japanese. For most of the history of computing, this meant that software had to be written, or at least translated, separately for every machine it ran on. If you wanted your accounting program to run on the IBM mainframe, and also on the Office workstation, and also on the new desktop computer, you had to compile it three times, one for each kind of processor. Every time a new chip arrived, every program in the world that wanted to run on it had to be rebuilt. James Gosling's wish, sitting in front of that oak tree, was that the rebuilding might not be his problem. The thinking went like this. Suppose there were a chip nobody ever built. Suppose this chip existed only as an idea, a published specification, a list of instructions it would understand if it were ever made out of silicon. And suppose you wrote a program in software that simulated this chip. The program would read the imaginary instructions and behave as if it were the imaginary processor, but it would do all of its actual work on whatever real chip happened to be underneath it. If such a thing were possible, you could write your program once against the imaginary chip, and you would only have to build that simulation program, the fake chip made of software, for each real machine, exactly once. Every program ever written against the imaginary chip would then run on every real machine that had the simulation installed. The translation cost would move from being a per-program cost to being a per-machine cost. The bargain would shift, and the world of software would change. That is the JVM. The Java Virtual Machine is, in the most literal sense, a fake computer. It is a program. It runs on real computers. When it runs, it pretends to be a chip that does not exist anywhere in any factory, a chip whose instructions are called bytecode. You write your Java program. A tool called the Java compiler turns it into a bytecode file, a thing with an extension like .class. The bytecode file is not machine code. No real chip can run it. The JVM reads the bytecode file, instruction by instruction, and turns each instruction into the actual machine code of whichever real chip you happen to be on. A Java program compiled in California in 1996 on a developer's desk will run today on a phone in Mumbai because the developer never had to know what chip the phone would have. The JVM does the translation work on every machine every time. This is what people mean when they say write once, run anywhere. It was in 1995 a startling claim. It turned out to be roughly true. Oracle, which now owns Java, has been claiming for years that Java runs on something between 3 billion and 13 billion devices, depending on which year and which tweet you read. The truth is somewhere in there. Every SIM card in every phone in the world runs a tiny version of Java called Java Card. Set-top boxes run Java. Blu-ray players run Java. Parking meters run Java. Payment terminals run Java. Most of the world's banks run their core systems on Java. Android, which is to say roughly 70% of the phones on Earth, runs a close cousin of the JVM. Some of the scientific instruments on Mars rovers run Java. The fake chip is everywhere. Now, an honest accounting requires us to talk about the costs. The first JVMs in 1995 and 96 were painfully slow. Pretending to be a chip is more expensive than being a chip. Reading bytecode one instruction at a time and translating it on the fly takes time that real chips do not have to spend. Sun knew this. They bought a startup in February of 1997 called Longview Technologies, and they used Longview's work to ship something called Hotspot, which became the standard JVM in May of 2000. Hotspot does something clever. It watches the program as it runs, notices which pieces of bytecode are getting executed over and over, and it quietly recompiles those pieces, only those, into real machine code on the fly, in the background. The hot paths get hot. The cold paths stay interpreted. This is called just-in-time compilation, JIT for short. After Hotspot, Java was fast enough to run banks. It still is. The second cost is memory. Java promises the programmer never has to free memory when they are done with it. The JVM tracks everything you create, and when it notices that you can no longer reach a piece of data from anywhere in your program, it quietly recycles the space. The piece of the JVM that does this is called the garbage collector, the GC. The first garbage collector was simple. It stopped the entire program, walked through every object in memory, marked the live ones, swept away the dead ones, and then started the program back up. The pauses were not subtle. The industry called them stop-the-world pauses, and that is exactly what they were. Over the years, smarter and smarter garbage collectors have been written. Serial, then parallel, then concurrent mark sweep, then G1, then ZC, then Shenandoah. Each one promises shorter pauses than the last. None has solved the problem completely. Every one is a trade-off between throughput and latency and memory headroom. And the last cost worth naming is startup. Spinning up a JVM is not instant. Even on a fast machine, it takes a noticeable fraction of a second, sometimes whole seconds, before the JVM has loaded itself, loaded your bytecode, and started running. For a long-lived process, a database, a web server, that startup time disappears into the noise. For 10,000 short jobs a day, it does not. These costs, the startup time, the memory overhead, the pauses are the price the JVM asks for the gift of write once, run anywhere. For 30 years, every major industry has accepted that price, and the bargain has paid off. The world the JVM made possible is enormous. Banks run on it. Phones run on it. Streaming services and shipping logistics and stock exchanges and supply chains and credit card networks all run, in part, on the JVM. The fake chip became the most successful runtime in the history of computing, and Oracle, which now stewards it, sells support contracts on it the way other companies sell rent. One last piece of plumbing matters for the rest of this season. In 2004, a Swiss professor named Martin Oderski released a new language called Scala, which I will pronounce Scala, and which compiles down to the same bytecode the JVM understands. Scala is what a Java programmer writes when they want a more concise, more modern way of expressing the same ideas, while still inheriting every library that has ever been written for Java. The JVM does not care what language produced the bytecode. Java, Scala, Kotlin, Clojure, Groovy, all of them compile to the same imaginary chip, and all of them run inside the same fake computer, with the same costs and the same gifts. 5 years after Scala arrived, a graduate student at Berkeley would pick it as the language for a side project that would, within a decade, run almost every analytical workload of consequence in the corporate world. That side project is where we are headed next. For you, as a listener, what to carry away is this. When somebody tells you that a program runs on the JVM, they're telling you something specific. They're telling you that the program was compiled, not to the chip it runs on, but to a fake chip that lives inside another program. They're telling you that the program inherited write once, run anywhere. They're also telling you that the program inherited the costs. It will take a little longer to start. It will use more memory than the same logic written in a language like C++ or Rust. It will every so often pause to recycle garbage. For many kinds of software, these costs do not matter at all. For some kinds, particularly software that has to run small, run fast, or run cheap, these costs matter enormously. The next four episodes of this season are about exactly that, about a piece of software whose architecture is the JVM's child, and about the people who decided the costs were no longer worth paying. Three things to carry away from today. The first is that the Java virtual machine is a fake computer made of software, an imaginary chip, that lets a program written once run on every real chip that has the JVM installed underneath it. The second is that the JVM made the modern world possible. Banks, phones, set-top boxes, payment networks, stock exchanges, all run on it by the billions of devices. The third is that this gift was not free. The JVM costs you startup time, memory, and the occasional pause for garbage collection. Most of the time, the trade is good. Sometimes it is not. Next time on Rust, gently, we take a particular piece of software built on top of this fake chip, the one called Apache Spark, which became the most important data tool of the last 15 years, and we trace it back to a graduate student in a Berkeley laboratory in 2009. Until then, take good care of yourself. I will see you in the next one.